It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. In Northeast Wisconsin, Lawrence University and the Trout Museum of Art are working together on a unique $38 million building project.
The two organizations are bringing together art, education, and housing in downtown Appleton.
The 120,000-square-foot project will feature the historic art museum on floor one, classrooms and offices on floor two, and dozens of apartments on floors three and four, not just for student housing.
The latest housing opportunity means renters in the Fox Cities can apply. We're learning more about the mixed-use building expected to open this fall and what it means for the future.
Lori Carter is the president of Lawrence University. Lori, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you, and good morning to you.
Well, what caught our eye about this project is it seems kind of outside the box, a little different sort of thing for a university doing. Can you give us the origin story of this collaboration with the Trout Museum of Art?
Well, Lawrence is, an important part of the Appleton community, as is the Trout Museum of Art. We were both in need of additional space, and it made sense for us to partner together on this project that really speaks to Lawrence's relationship with the community and Trout's place in the community. We are also, as an institution, looking at ways to more deeply connect our students, not just with the community, but with life after Lawrence. And so the opportunity to partner with a community organization that will allow our students internship, job shadowing, and mentoring opportunities made sense.
And then the housing part of this is interesting. Pretty common for universities to build student housing. Well, this is not just a student housing thing. What went into that component of this plan?
Well, Lawrence is, we have a growth plan for our student population, but we also needed new academic space. And so to help us achieve our goal of developing this space, we created a revenue stream to support the functioning of the building. And so the apartments on the top two floors are really a revenue stream for us while we're getting the building up and running and growing our enrollment.
And as part of the Appleton community, you know, communities around the state dealing with issues of housing availability, workforce housing, things like that, was that part of your conversation with the wider Appleton community in developing this?
Absolutely. We studied the housing needs in our community, particularly in the downtown area where there is a real desire for folks to live downtown. And as an institution that cares about our community, and in thinking about the project, we thought, what better way for us to make contributions, not just in supporting our relationship with Trout, but also in building housing, which will serve a real need for our community.
Can you talk about the funding? A lot of times, you know, a commercial developer will look for some kind of tax incremental financing or some kind of public support. A lot of fundraising was involved in this by Lawrence and by the Trout Museum. What ends up paying for all of this?
Absolutely. Fundraising was a key component of this. So both Lawrence and Trout have been fundraising for the project. Lawrence was gifted with a $10 million gift, which seeded the project for us, and Trout contributed their portion. And as I said, the apartments on the top two floors will be a continuous revenue stream for us. So the funding was sort of mixed use, just the way the building is.
And as I mentioned, this seemed to us here at Wisconsin Today to be unique. Did you have models of other universities around the country doing similar things, or were you kind of inventing something new here?
Well, I'm not inventing something new. I was involved in a project of this type in 1990 in Lincoln Center, where several institutions got together and created office space for themselves as well as other artistic space. And there were apartments connected to it. So it's a model I knew and saw work very effectively, and it is still working effectively today.
We're talking to Lori Carter, president of Lawrence University. They're partnering with the Trout Museum of Art in Appleton on a new facility. It'll be a new house for the art museum, a classroom and office space for the university, and housing on the top two floors. Lori, what is the timeline now? Construction is well underway, it sounds like.
Construction is underway, and we will move into the building in time for our fall term. Our faculty is very excited about the opportunity for the academic programming that will occur in this building. Trout will move in, I believe, a couple of months before us, but the building is on schedule. It's actually ahead of schedule. And we are really looking forward to taking possession of it and putting it to use in a way the community can really benefit.
I want to key in on something you mentioned earlier, that you're looking for enrollment growth at Lawrence University. Now, we've talked on the show about the challenges facing small and mid-sized universities, public and private, often declining enrollment, demographics, meaning, hey, there are just fewer traditional college-age people coming down the pipeline. How are you at Lawrence looking to deal with that?
Well, this is part of how we're dealing with it. We are really looking at every aspect of the university. And we're listening to the public discourse about higher education, and Lawrence is responding to that. We are a liberal arts institution, and we are committed to the liberal arts. We also understand that students need to understand how to use that liberal arts toolkit in a way that speaks to their life after Lawrence. And so, this West Campus project, as well as another project that we opened earlier this year, are really a part of that, deepening our connections with the community so students understand, while they're students, how to use the skills they're learning at Lawrence in the workplace. It's a really exciting opportunity for us, and it speaks to the needs of our community, really developing the workforce with the students that are here. Connecting the students with the community so they know how to be good citizens, and having them understand that a liberal arts education is very meaningful.
How do you reach out to the community and other organizations to try to build those connections and to gain an understanding of what's needed and how to connect your students to the needs of the community?
Well, Lawrence University is a steward of place. We understand that that Appleton and Lawrence are interdependent. So we have many members of our community who are deeply engaged with community organizations and businesses. I do a lot of that work myself. We ask the community what it needs of us, and we try to fill that need. And we do it in a way that also helps our students understand how to use their education in the future. So for us, it's a win-win situation. It's very exciting to be a part of a community that really embraces the university and the way we are educating our students. Our students are going out into the world and they are leading in tremendous ways. And these collaborations are really reinforcing our ability to continue to send Laurentians out and change the world.
Now, when people think of the college experience, they might think of, okay, that new high school graduate. They go to school for 4 years, they graduate. I know down the street from you at UW-Green Bay, we've heard, they're focusing on getting high school students and having classes for them and reaching out to people later in life and later in their careers to gain a different kind of university experience. Is that part of your equation there at Lawrence as well?
We are certainly working with high schools in the region. We are developing special summer programs that will allow students to have a Lawrence experience during the summer and really get to know what it means to be on a college campus. This fall, we piloted a program called Lawrence at Night, which is an adult learning program that we intend to grow and once again meet the needs of our community and the things they are looking for from an institution that is so important to uplifting the entire community.
Now, as I mentioned, comparable campuses around the state, around the country, are dealing with the same issues you are there at Lawrence. If you could give advice to people in similar institutions, what would you suggest to them if they're not as far along as you are in making those community connections?
I would tell them to understand that they are a steward of place. And what that means is that you can't exist in isolation within your community. Get to know the community, deepen ties with the community, know what they need from you, and respond to that. while you're responding to the public discourse about higher education. A four-year degree is valuable. The research has stated that for decades. We know that people with a degree will have a different earning potential over the course of their life. But life is not just about money. It's also about connecting. It is about giving back. It is about being part of a community and serving that community in a way that allows it to serve others.
Bringing things back around to this project now with the Trout Museum, with Lawrence, and with housing. A year or two from now, what does success look like for you? What was going to make you say, yes, this is a great investment, it's paying off?
Success looks like our students connecting with the Trout Museum of Art in ways that inform their education. The Trout feeling as though the collaboration is really helping their organization grow and develop. And our academic space being fully activated with learning and innovation in ways that speak to the future.
And what's your message to maybe other institutions, other community groups in Appleton and the neighboring Fox Cities area on ways they could partner with you at Lawrence?
We are always open to exploring partnerships that will elevate the community and help inform our students about the future. So if anyone is interested in connecting with us, feel free to reach out. Conversations are happening all of the time, and I can tell you this is a very exciting time for Lawrence and for the community because the connections are deepening on a daily basis. So
Lori.
please let us know.
Lori, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Lori Carter, president of Lawrence University, a private institution, liberal arts college, famous conservatory of music in Appleton, talking about a new collaboration project with the Trout Museum of Art in Appleton.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, a series of layoffs hit the broadcast TV news industry in Wisconsin.
Ultimately, the public just knows a little bit less, or maybe a lot less, about what's happening in their hometown.
Find out how a nationwide trend in declining local news coverage affects communities around the state. That's ahead on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. More layoffs have hit Wisconsin's television news industry. Los Angeles-based Allen Media Group owns stations in four Wisconsin markets. Last month, it reduced the size of its newsrooms in La Crosse, Eau Claire, and Wausau.
The latest round of layoffs has changed the way these stations cover news in their broadcasts, furthering a trend of declining local news coverage across the country.
We're checking in on what these losses mean for the communities they cover with Mike Wagner, professor and director of the Center for Communication and Civic Renewal at the UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication. Mike, welcome back to Wisconsin Today.
It's great to be here.
We think about local news declines in the newspaper industry. Thousands of local newspapers shuttered since 2005, but we're seeing local television facing similar declines. Is that right?
We're seeing local television stations experience less investment from their owners, and so reporters are tasked with doing more stories for more newscasts, plus do stuff for the web, plus do stuff for social media, all in the job of also trying to chase down the verifiable truth about important matters for their audience. And so it's getting harder and harder for local television journalists to accomplish that goal, given all that they're asked to do in an increasingly difficult economic environment.
Is it clear what's causing revenues to decline for local television? What do you see out there?
It's not even the case that revenues are all declining. Many local television news stations are extremely healthy. Local television news is still the most watched and most trusted source for information. That's true in Wisconsin, and it's also true nationally. There's increasing economic pressures to not just make money, but to make more money. And each time a local television station makes more money, especially after an election year where there are lots of campaign ads that help generate revenue, there's increasing pressure to keep that going. But of course, there's less of those kinds of ads happening in the off-election years. And so when there's a little bit of a reduction in what stations might make, they might think that they're doing worse, or at least their boards might think that they're doing worse than they really are.
Well, let's put a finer point on that. The Wesleyan Media Project tracked spending in the November election. They found TV ads dominated federal and statewide election spending. And with record-setting advertising, $770 million going toward ads on local and national
cable networks.
So is that trickling down to local TV news operations?
Trickling is probably the right word. It's not supporting them in the way that it could. And it's often the case where larger companies are buying up more and more stations. They want them to be more profitable, and gathering the news and doing a good job of it is expensive. And so reducing reporters, cutting the number of producers, cutting people who are, you know, photojournalists and camera operators, those are all ways that you can make a little bit of money and also reduce the quality of your product. And they hope not by enough to lose viewers, but we're getting close to a tipping point, I think.
Allen Media, they own the four stations in Wisconsin, and they're operating in 22 markets across the country. And the company told the LA Times last year in a statement that it's making strategic changes to position the company for growth that will result in workforce reductions across all divisions. So can you kind of parse that language? How do layoffs help a broadcast company grow?
I think what they mean is we're going to fire reporters, producers, and photojournalists so that we can do lower quality news that looks close enough to what people are getting now that we hope they don't notice.
What does that do to a community?
Local television news and local newspapers and local radio are information that can bind communities together. So much of our politics is nationalized, and by that I mean polarized and deeply divided. And so when people go to national sources for information, it's very much my team versus your team. What can we learn about the other side that's terrible? What can we do to brag about our side? Local news is one of the last places that's widely trusted by the left and the right, that's widely used by the left and the right, and also covers things that aren't just about politics, but are about snow removal and high school sports and the local weather and people doing things in the community that might need a little bit of help to do some good. And being able to tell those stories and do so in a way that's trusted and credible is critically important to bind communities together. And local news also provides critical information about local issues. People need to know if they have to boil their water before they drink it, or if there's problems in their school board, or if there's embezzlement happening at City Hall. And so these are all things people need to know to make good decisions as citizens, whether it's can I drive down Monroe Street today, or is it going to be closed, to what kind of education are my kids getting, what kind of services is my city providing for me.
I think you're also pointing to this notion that it's really hard to cover a community when you're not in the community.
It's so hard.
And I'm wondering, what are those ripple effects when the content is coming from the outside, or it's generated from, you know, some other place, when it's not locally generated from a journalist who's living it?
Everybody knows that you have a better experience when you are at something than when you are virtually at it. Right. If we're in a meeting and we're face to face, then you know that I'm not going to take out my phone and just start scrolling while we're talking. Right. But if we're on Zoom, I can do that. And if I hold my phone under my camera, it still looks like I'm looking at the screen, but I'm still scrolling. Right. And so local news is a place that prizes being there and seeing things, but also it prizes having that community knowledge, knowing what has happened in the past. Is the reason this issue is coming up because it was contentious in the past? Is the reason this issue is coming up because it was a campaign promise from the person who won the mayoral race or county executive race or something like that? And if you don't have that knowledge, which local reporters tend to have way more than the average bear, then we don't get the kind of detailed and informative reporting that helps us know how do we hold our public officials to account.
Is there still a glamour to TV news, of being on TV in 2025, or has the rise of social media influencers and streaming really changed that perspective?
It's a little different in that anybody with a camera phone can digitally broadcast themselves on social media at a moment's notice, but there's still something that's different about being on local television news. And that's the same with being on the radio or being in the mm-hmm. newspaper. It's official, right? It has the gravitas of people get in trouble if what they tell you on these platforms is false, right? Mm-hmm. People can lose their jobs, whereas if I'm just streaming whatever I want to on Instagram or TikTok, I can't lose my job as a influencer by saying mm-hmm. things that aren't true. I might lose audience members, but I don't lose my job in the way that a reporter does. And so when it's on television, it's something that other people see. It's something that we expect to be true. It's something where we expect there to be consequences if something isn't true. And so there's a little bit more of an elevated sense of importance when things are in the news media versus when they're just on social media.
You're around so many students on campus. I wonder, what are their thoughts? What kind of news, what kind of journalism do they want to get into now as they see these layoffs?
A lot of our students are getting interested in data journalism, so telling stories, telling visual stories with evidence. So some of that might be doing data visualizations. Some of that might be doing kind of crunching spreadsheet numbers or doing the kind of thing you might see on 538 or on Vox. That's something that's grown more popular. And then more niche outlets where people are focused on a particular area of expertise. A lot of my former students have gone into banking reporting or reporting about the Air Force, right? So specific things where there are not a lot of places that you can report, but the people who want that information really want that information.
So as you step back and you look at Wisconsin's local news industry, what strikes you? How is it doing?
Well, it varies by where we are in the state. Like Madison has a really robust information environment with lots of different kinds of sources for news about state and local politics and neighborhood politics and race and gender and all those kinds of things. But then you get into other parts of the state that are more rural, and their newspapers might be weekly or online only. Their television stations are doing what Allen Media is doing and cutting a lot of local reporters and hoping that their affiliates in a larger city can fill in the back end of newscasts. And so the quality of the information environment varies. Public radio, public television are kind of constants across the state. And then local, true what's happening in our county, that varies quite a bit by largely by how many people live there and how close they are to a metro area.
When you see decisions at local media outlets, for-profit outlets, these media holdings make decisions looking like it's based on revenue, is that worrisome to you as a journalism professor?
It really is. I mean, I understand that businesses are, you know, first and foremost in business to make money. But the news media, newspapers, radio, television, especially radio and television, where they're on the airwaves, that are part of a public trust, there used to be a sense of it was okay to lose a little bit of money in this kind of endeavor so that we provide critical information to people so they can make good decisions about how to live their lives and who they want to support. And once it became clear that television news could make money, that became the expectation instead of how can we do really robust, detailed, high-quality investigative stories. And when you cut newsrooms, it is way easier to go, well, crime, weather, sports. Those are easy things to cover. We can do it all day, every day on the cheap. Whereas what's happening in our government? What's happening to our kids in school? What are the long-term trends of stuff that we care about as a community in terms of our health, our education, our economic, success and failure? There you got to have reporters digging, and that is costly. It takes time. And instead, what TV stations are doing are adding newscasts. So instead of adding reporters, they have a 4, a 5, a 6, and a 10, and a noon, and a morning show. And so it's really difficult to fill all of that time with thoroughly reported stories when you have a skeleton staff.
With that in mind, what are you watching for industry-wide in 2025? What might we expect?
Looking for tipping points? Are there newsrooms that have been cut so much that they start to lose audience to stations that are doing a better job of covering local markets? You know, most places don't have competing newspapers in the way that Madison does, right? Mm-hmm. But they have competing television stations. And so people do have a place to go with their eyeballs at you know, 7 in the morning, noon, 5, 4, 5, 6, and 10. And so I'll be looking to see if the places that have been cutting lose viewers.
Mike, thank you so much for your insights. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Mike Wagner is a professor and director of the Center for Communication and Civic Renewal at the UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication. We've been talking about recent layoffs in TV news in Wisconsin and how it affects the communities they cover. Now we'll zoom in on one of those affected communities to find out how local news coverage is changing. Tom Giffey is managing editor of Volume One. That's a biweekly culture and entertainment publication for the Chippewa Valley. He previously covered politics and business for the Leader-Telegram in Eau Claire. Tom, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
It's great to be here.
Allen Media Group didn't make a formal announcement of these TV layoffs at WQOW in Eau Claire and elsewhere in Wisconsin. How did the community start to find out?
Well, they found out when they tuned in one evening back in about a month ago in December and noticed that there were some folks missing that they were used to looking at up here at WQOW, which is the ABC affiliate. Notably, that was Keith Edwards, who has been on television for well over a decade and before that for a couple of decades in local radio. So he is perhaps one of the most recognizable folks in town, and suddenly, without any explanation, he wasn't there.
Being in the local community as a journalist and being on the air locally for decades, as you mentioned, with Keith Edwards, what did he mean to the community, and what do you see as the impact of his loss?
I mean, he meant, obviously, in a medium market like this, a relatively small media market, people come to know, or at least feel they know and trust people like him who have been around, you know, and giving them the news, good and bad, for years and years. As a journalist myself, somebody who I worked a long time at the daily newspaper in town, I mean, he was somebody that was roundly respected among journalists as well for being, you know, not just a guy on the radio or a guy on TV, but somebody who could work his sources and could get stories that other people would be, you know, competitors would be envious of. So he's somebody who had, you know, both the polish you need in broadcasting as well as the shoe leather skills as a journalist that are important to have in a community. So it was a big loss. And of course, he wasn't the only one, as you referred to. There were other folks laid off here and other folks at, I believe, in Wausau and La Crosse at stations that have the same owner.
You know, overall, how do you evaluate the strength or the health of local media coverage? Because you're in it, you're living it as well. What do you see?
I mean, it certainly has declined over the years. I mean, what you might consider a little bit of a non-traditional media outlet. We cover arts and entertainment, but as well as some hard news and community goings on that might have been covered by more traditional outlets in the past, but they simply don't have the folks anymore. You know, the daily newspaper here in town, like many, the Leader-Telegram, still soldiers on, but there are far fewer people in the newsroom than there were 10, 20, 30 years ago. And the same, of course, is true for the commercial television stations, the commercial radio stations, which have virtually no local news, or very little anyway. So we are certainly a microcosm of many other communities coast to coast that, you know, have suffered that decline, you know, and we can certainly point at the internet and social media and plenty of other factors, but it as they, to quote a cliche, it is what it is here, and it's the same all across the country.
Hear, hear. Yeah. Tom, as we wrap up, I mean, it always seems like these conversations of a shrinking local news environment You know, there aren't many bright spots, but where do you see hope? Where do you see potential?
I mean, there is creativity out there. You know, as I alluded to, the elephant in the room is the internet and all that local advertising money that used to flow into local broadcasters and local newspapers. When I started in this business 25 years ago, you know, you had a great big fat Sunday paper with all the auto dealerships and real estate ads and all that stuff that has largely gone away because those people are advertising on the internet. But that money is still there, and there are creative people trying to do creative things. I hope we are would be considered among them. But, you know, for example, in our coverage area is the city of Menominee, which is considers itself, local folks have kind of declared themselves a news desert. And there's a couple of nonprofit and startup things happening in that town to do coverage online and push it through social media. And I think that's happened a lot. You have, you know, standalone journalists who do work and, you know, get themselves supported, whether it be a podcast or a Substack or any of those things. And so I think there is hope in creativity, but the media environment looks a lot different than it did. And it certainly, if you look down the road in a few years, it's going to look even more different. And hopefully there will be people with the creativity and the entrepreneurship to fill those gaps.
Well, Tom, good to talk with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome, and thank you for the opportunity.
That is Tom Giffey, managing editor of Volume One. It's a biweekly culture and entertainment publication for the Chippewa Valley. With us to look at how media coverage has changed in Eau Claire as local news outlets have seen cutbacks. And earlier, we talked to UW-Madison journalism professor Mike Wagner about what's driving layoffs in the local TV news industry.
Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, Wisconsin's new poet laureate shares her passion for writing in verse.
I learned so much through reading the poems of others and through making my own. Oftentimes you can learn something about yourself.
Self-discovery through poetry, that's next here on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Fairhead. Wisconsin's 11th Poet Laureate begins a three-year term tomorrow. The Poet Laureate serves as the state's ambassador of poetry and inspires people with creativity through workshops, projects, and meeting with young people.
We get to meet the state's new Poet Laureate now, Milwaukee native Brenda Cardenas. She works with ekphrastic poetry, where poetry collides with visual art, and she flows between Spanish and English, which she calls interlingual poems, as the two languages combine to make something new. Brenda, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Hi, I'm so glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
What does it mean to be a poet ambassador for all of Wisconsin?
Well, I think it means that one sets out to, you know, bring the beauty and the joy and the learning experiences that poets know we can have from poetry to everyone that has any kind of interest at all, whether it is that they have read a poem or two and they've really enjoyed reading them, or they've dabbled themselves at writing, or maybe they're, you know, professional poets who published a lot. It doesn't matter. But to reach out to the people of the state and help them to learn to appreciate poetry, the reading of it and the writing of it.
Can you acquaint us with your poetry and how you like to approach your writing?
Everything under the sun, I think, is game for a poet. We can make, I've seen poets make amazing poems out of writing about their pencil, right? To writing about major emotions or major world events. Some of my poems are interlingual, so they move back and forth between Spanish and English, as Spanish is one of my languages, and they are, you know, about culture. I grew up in Milwaukee as a Mexican-American woman, and so some of them touch on that. But I'm also really devoted to the environment and trying to deal with things like climate change and protecting what we have left of our natural resources, et cetera. My process of writing, usually I will get, sometimes it's an idea that comes to me, but more often than not, I like to just start with language. So some phrase that's especially sonorous or rhythmic or just interesting in terms of the turn of phrase, a phrase in which things are stated in a way I've never heard them stated before, that will come to me. And then I'll put that down on the page and write from there. The poem will emerge from that language. I meet every week with a women's writers group, a poets group. And every week, it's a generative writing workshop. So rather than critiquing each other's work, we're there to write together. And so some of the exercises that we do in the group often launch poems. Sometimes something in the news launches a poem, or another poem that I read, or another poet that I've been studying, or some prose work I read will launch a poem. There's so many different ways to go about it.
We're talking with Milwaukee native Brenda Cardenas, Wisconsin's new poet laureate. Brenda, you work with musicians and have set two of your poems to music, including Para los Tintunteros, set to choral music by Daniel Afonso. Let's take a listen. Este para los timbaleros, los bateristas, los tintunteros. In English, it's two percussionists, is that right? Celebrating people,
yes,
who make rhythm?
It's a poem in honor of drummers of all kinds, right? Timbaleros would be those who play the timbales. Any kind of percussionist, you know, from a drummer that plays on a big drum set to somebody who slaps, you know, congas or bongos or whatever it is. And yeah, that poem I wrote in Spanish, and then I did my own translation of it into English. And it's in my first full-length book, Boomerang. But this composer, he was looking for a poem in Spanish to set to choral music. And somebody, and I don't know who, somebody out there in California had that book and said, well, have you ever read this poem by Brenda Cardenas? And he said, no. And he looked at it and he decided that that was the poem that he wanted to compose music for. So it was a great blessing.
So when you composed the poem, you had no idea that one day it would be set to choral music?
In this case, no.
Wow.
I had no idea. And had really absolutely no idea that it would end up published by Hal Leonard, which is the music with the words in it. That's the largest, you know, music publisher, I believe, in the nation. And that it would end up being performed at Carnegie Hall. I actually went to Carnegie Hall.
Oh,
to
my
hear
goodness.
It.
What was that like for you to hear it?
It was just so amazing because it was a very large choir. I don't remember how many people were in it, but a lot of people, like more than 50 people in this choir. And to hear this whole choir singing my words, just, you know, it just blew my mind. It was nothing but delight. And, you know, my husband was with me and several very good friends who live in New York. And the person who conducted the choir for that was just a wonderful, beautiful man who was dancing as he was conducting. So
I can imagine it just took your breath away.
Well, the music's so beautiful. I mean, I can't thank Daniel Afonso enough for writing such an incredible score.
I want to turn to the project that you'll take on as poet laureate. Part of being the poet laureate is proposing a specific project to work on during the term. So what is your project?
So I've always been interested in inter-arts, as we just talked about with the music, the coming together of different art forms. And I've written a lot of poems that are called ekphrastic poems, which simply means that they are poems that are written in response to or in conversation with or in correspondence with visual art. My project is to build a website that has all of my materials on it about ekphrastic poetry and a video of me on there talking about ekphrastic poetry. And then for me to go to the different major regions of the state and do workshops on this and to have basically relays happening in different regions of the state simultaneously. So if you imagine an octopus with the different legs, right?
Yep.
To have perhaps poets that I contact ahead of time to get it going, right, to start it, write an ekphrastic poem in response to any piece of visual art they want to. And then that poem will be sent to visual artists who I've previously contacted, and visual artists will respond in through visual art to the poem that they were sent. Hmm. Then those visual artists will send their piece of visual art, a photograph of it, of course, to another poet who has signed up to be in the project. So it will be kind of like the game of telephone, if you remember that.
Yes.
From when we were children, or I describe it as a relay, but there'll be like maybe 6-8 different relays happening in different parts of the state at the same time. And it'll eventually, you know, I'm hoping that only in terms of my choosing, who gets involved, that will only be for the first round to get things going.
Oh,
and then
okay.
Anybody who wants to will sign up on the website. The website will have that capability where people can sign up there and they can see which poets haven't been part of it yet, which visual artists haven't participated yet, and they can choose somebody and send it on to them. Right. And
yeah.
So that anybody who wants to will be able to participate, not only people I know and not only people who fancy themselves professional poets or artists, but even people who just dabble or just want to try it out.
It would be so fun to see an exhibit at the end, the evolution of it all, and watching it through, seeing it through the stages and reading those poems through the stages. That would be so much fun.
I'm hoping that all of the work will end up housed on the website.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah,
so that even after I'm no longer Poet Laureate, people can still go back and look at, poets can still go and look at the visual art that's up there and say, hey, I'm going to try writing a poem in response to this. I really love this piece, or vice versa.
Brenda, I wonder if you would share some of your poetry with us, and you could read Deportation.
Yes, I will. I'm happy to. This is a brand new poem. It's titled Deportation. We were all once citizens of snow, born beneath the stretched skins, taut tarps of our sisters and brothers, stateless citizens of desert doorways, so low our kin had to bow to greet us as we entered the arc of this world. We each held a bowl of slate blue sky, and wherever we carried it, welcomed us home. See, there are no nations, no papers, no passports. There are no quotients in this genius heritage, only jungles of bougainvillea that reach like bodies to the morning sun, iguana tails smacking still air, only ladders to other levels of love.
Thank you so much. You know, I love that pop of color at the end in the poem with suddenly the bougainvillea makes me a little more uplifted. I really love that because there's something joyous in the ending, only ladders to other levels of love.
Exactly.
Thank
you.
Yes. What inspired you? What were you thinking about in this poem? Of course, immigration, mass deportation, some of those heavier things we also hear in this poem as well.
Yes. I mean, that was part of it. I was thinking about this notion of just deporting everybody, you know, who is not here, quote unquote, legally, and thinking about just how dreadful that idea is and how would the people in the United States really even eat, or, you know, what would the prices of our groceries look like if we really did deport everyone, right, who's picking our food. But so, yes, those ideas were in the back of my mind. But the poem really started in that writing group I'm in. Yeah. And so it started looking at the word grid and seeing the word snow in the grid in one corner of the grid and seeing the word citizen in another corner of the grid. And just boom, I had that first line. We were all once citizens of snow. And from there, the poem unfolded.
Brenda, there is a lot of hurt in our world. There's tragedy and there's disasters. Mm-hmm. I wonder, does pain affect your poetry?
Certainly. Certainly, yes. I have, you know, both personal pain. My very youngest brother died when he was only 51 or 52 years old in 2019 of heart failure. And certainly I wrote about that in poetry. I happened to lose a lot of people. It was kind of my season of death around that time. And so that aunt and uncle who left me the house I'm living in, my father, my brother. And then as well as the larger pain, right, of a world we live in that unfortunately we're so fallible as human beings, right? There's always war happening somewhere. There's poverty, right? There's, like I said, these disasters of climate that we're seeing. So whether it's a larger pain that many of us share, or whether it's a very personal thing, I certainly do respond to that in my work, as well as to joy.
I would love to leave it with joy and where you find the joy in making poems and what you could leave with others so that they too would turn to poetry and not say, oh, no, I can't do that. Or, oh, you know, that poetry is not for me.
Well, I find the joy in two things. One of it is just playing with language. You get to play. Think of it as play. Think of words as a whole bunch of toys or little blocks you're going to build something with, whatever it is, and enjoy the ride through this beautiful, you know, language or languages, right, that you have, the muscularity of language, again, the musicality of language. So that's part of it. And for me also, I learned so much through reading the poems of others and through making my own. Oftentimes you can learn something about yourself that's deep inside of yourself that you're not necessarily aware of, right, in your conscious mind. But when you start to write poems, those things emerge, right? And you can learn about yourself and about others.
Oh, Brenda, this has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. Really happy to have been here.
Brenda Cardenas is the new Poet Laureate of Wisconsin, and her 3-year term, it starts tomorrow.
We just heard from Wisconsin's new Poet Laureate, and last week we called for your poetry.
A listener named Will answered the call, sent us a few poems. Thank you so much, Will. Here's one of them, a shorter one, written in 1960. It's called Spring, Spring, Sprung. Here goes. I am a muddy March child full of puddles and dirty ice, some parts loose, others stiff, so much potential stuck fast, a lion hidden in lambskin thawing.
Thanks again, Will. And you can share your poetical works with us. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/wisconsintoday. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.